Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
What the f*** is that?
It's the new Bell and Sebastian.
It's the record we've been listening to and enjoying, Barry.
Well, that's unfortunate, because it sucks ass. Yours, I assume? Okay, buddy, I was just trying to cheer us up, so go ahead. Put on some old sad bastard music, see if I care.
I don't want to hear old sad bastard music, Barry. I just want something I can ignore.
Here's the thing. I made that tape special for today. My special Monday morning tape for you. Special!
Well, it's f***ing Monday afternoon. You should get out of bed earlier.
Come on, dude. Play it. Don't you want to hear what's next?
What's next?
Play it!
Say it.
Little Latin loopy-loo.
Mitch Ryder and the Detroit Wheels?
No!
The Righteous Brothers.
Well, never mind.
No, not never mind. You tell me right now what's wrong with the Righteous Brothers.
Nothing. I just prefer the other...
Bullshit!
How can it be bullshit to state a preference? Since when did this store become a fascist regime?
Since you brought that bullshit tape in.
Oh, man, that's great. That's the fun thing about working in a record store. You get to play crappy pap you don't even want to listen to. I thought this tape was going to be a fucking... conversation stimulator, man.
After the hour of one, and this is the month of March, in the year of our Lord, 2011. Draw near, that ye might be amused and informed. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network, looming high above the Milkpacking District, here in beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. Thank you for joining us on this Monday, and welcome to Day 12. It is Monday, March the 7th, 2011. My name is Rick Emerson. I will be your humble narrator for today. It is 503-505-6964. If you want, you should be part of the program. Share your thoughts with the giggling masses and so forth. It's 503-505-6964. If you would like to weigh in with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ponderings, ruminations, musings of an ironic nature, threats, recriminations, excoriations, half-truths, deceptions, outright lies, red herrings, whatever it is you got. It's 503-505-6964, 503-505-6964. Today's program brought to you by Mr. and Mrs. Emerson. Also by E.H. Vending. You can find out more about them at ehvending.com. Hello, Don Taylor. How are you?
I'm peachy.
How's your bod?
How's my witch?
Oh, it's going to be the best day ever. I was a little Ferris Bueller there. I said, "How's your bod?"
Yeah, I'm on the downslope from a cold.
Is that good or bad?
I think that's good. I mean, that means I was sick for 2 days straight, and now I'm better than I was, but I'm still a little on the ill side. But I'm skating out of it. I don't know. See, that's the thing.
You're on the downside of a thing that you're skating.
I'm never sure if, like, when you say something is, it's all downhill from here, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
We've had this discussion, you and I have. We had this discussion on the last show, on the last iteration of the Rick Emerson show.
Did we?
I think it was one of the first days that you were with Sarah and I, and I said something very similar to, Don Taylor, you're a wordsmith. You work with letters and vowels and consonants and diacritical marks and things. And you said yes. And I said, what is the deal with, it's all uphill, it's all downhill. And we came... The conclusion we came to was that, like, an eye of the beholder sort of a thing.
Yeah, it's
because
kind
if something
contextual.
Is all downhill, you feel like it's going to be easy. But on the other hand, sometimes if it's all downhill, you don't want that. Like, if your cancer's all downhill, that means don't start any long novels, you know? So I don't think we. I think
whenever somebody says it's all uphill from here, it's downhill from here, they always mean it's going to be hard, or it's like bad or something. But it seems like if going uphill is hard, then going downhill should be easy.
It's like a relative difficulty version of that. You know, what is something if it's bi-monthly?
Yeah.
I think the conclusion we came to, and this is now, I'm going back like 3 years for this, but I think the conclusion that we came to is that we were going to try to find somebody from, like, Webster's or somebody from, you know, from the, like, the American, you know, Society for the, like, Preservation of Linguistic Tight-Acidness, and we were going to ask them, you know, like, what is the deal with it's all uphill, all downhill? And then we just, and then I was distracted by a cricket or something, yeah. and it just never happened, so...
Well, but anyway, I had a cold.
You're feeling better.
It started on the way home from work on Friday. I felt like that sort of burning kind of sensation in my throat, and I started sneezing. And I got home, and by Friday night, I was just ill. And then I figured it out. I actually did the math, and I honestly believe that out of, like, about 46 solid hours of weekend, I think I slept some, like, 39 of those hours.
That's impressive. I mean, except it's impressive in this horrible way. You slept for 39 of 48 hours, but probably didn't enjoy it all that much in the strictest sense.
I enjoyed quite a lot of it, because it's like I'd get up and I'd take... It was that thing of getting up, taking some cold medicine, then going and getting in bed and going, oh, yeah, blessed cold medicine.
It's all so clear.
And then just going into a coma, and then waking up 3 hours later and going, oh, I can't take any cold medicine yet, but... And then kind of tossing and turning for a while, getting up, drinking some water... Then taking the cold medicine, going back to sleep. You know, about the fourth time getting up and going, I should eat something, and having, like, some peanut butter toast, and then taking more cold medicine, going back to sleep.
I don't think that's really enjoying the sleeping so much as it is enjoying the cold medicine while you're in a prone position.
Kind of, yeah.
That's enjoying... Really. That is an incidental horizontal alignment of your body that really just exists as an adjunct to filling yourself with chemicals.
Yeah, at some point I took a shower, a hot shower, and then took more cold medicine, and then got into bed and went, oh, I'm nice and clean and full of cold medicine. And went back to sleep again. So
awesome.
That's honest to God, that's all I did. I got up. At one point, I was up for a solid, like, 2 hours. I know because Patrick and I watched Tangled. He hadn't seen Tangled, and that seemed like a good while-I'm-sick thing. And then I went back to bed again. And so,
the question is, where's your cold medicine now? Where is your cold medicine now?
I actually just took some. You'll see this coffee cup here had water in it, and I put my little, I don't have the packet now, but I put my little packet of Alka-Seltzer cold medicine in it, and I just drank it
You're taking the Alka-Seltzer, is it the Alka-Seltzer cold and cough? The Alka-Seltzer,
Just the blue original kind.
Not like the pale blue original kind.
No.
Because that's just for, like, when you have too much of your grandmother's meatloaf or something.
No.
You're talking about the dark blue packet?
Yeah, the actual cold medicine.
Ah, okay. See, there you go.
So that one.
Here's the thing. I'm a big fan of Alka-Seltzer, and I know that to some degree, I know that the business of the, the fizzing and the, you know, whatever it is, the sort of packing it with carbon dioxide or something, I know that that's just sort of a marketing shill. That's just a thing so you can feel like it, you can feel the efficacy of it. But on the other hand, I got to tell you, I don't know.
It works, though. It makes me feel like I'm doing something.
That's the thing about it, is it would probably work just as well without the bubbles, except that you feel like you've taken positive steps. Here's the thing about Alka-Seltzer with bubbles as opposed to just like, because, like, you can take it as, like, I don't know, like a pill or something now, or like one of those gel caps. The thing about it is, when you take Alka-Seltzer in the tablet form, you know, with the tablet fizzy form, you feel as though you are ingesting something space age. You feel as though, like, you've put science into your body. Whereas the other thing feels like you're eating one of those Haribo gummy things. You know, like you're eating also like what you eat like a cola bottle or something for the Haribo company.
I'm also a huge fan of the Alka-Seltzer Plus cold medicine because it really does a nice job of helping to gently knock me out enough to get me to sleep so I can sleep through most of my cold. But if I don't want to sleep, I can take it and it doesn't make me drowsy enough that it knocks me out.
Don't they just give you Vicodin by the pound at your doctor's office?
Yeah.
Can't you just, if you take enough of those, won't you go to sleep?
Yeah, but that won't keep the crud from running down the back of my throat and then strangling me while I'm unconscious.
That's some aggressive crud. In fact, I don't even really know that's the crud. I think you're filled with the stuff.
Plus, I just had that whole cold thing going on where it was just, I was achy all over and I kept sneezing and my throat was...
Say it.
What?
Come on, say it.
I don't know what you want me to say.
You just said achy and sneezing and sniffling.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to say whatever it is for the...
Yeah.
The thing. I don't know how that goes. The achy, sniffly, sneezing all over something. I can't remember how that goes.
Oh, now see, now you put me on the spot and I can see if I can do it. Because I used to be able to do both... Here... I say this as though it's an actual achievement. This goes a long way toward explaining why I'm at this station in life. Because this counts... I was just about to be angry at myself for not remembering the NyQuil... not even jingle, but the NyQuil catchphrase. The achy, stuffy, sneezing, coughing... God damn it. I don't think I can do it anymore. I used to be able to do both the DayQuil and, here's the thing, the NyQuil... Or the NyQuil and the DayQuil version of it. Because it was the daytime version to put you to sleep. Coughing, sneezing, fever, stuffy, headache... No. Stuffy hip fever so you can rest. God damn it.
Yeah. You're close. You're circling around it.
These are the ravages of age, Dawn. This is really what it is. This is when it all comes home.
And you are, as Sheriff John, the fellow who did the birthday show when I was a kid on TV, you say... You are another year old today.
Nighttime sniffling, sneezing, coughing, stuffy head, achy fever, so you can rest medicine.
There you go.
In your face, age. And Dawn, and age. Yeah.
In fact, I will sing you that song now because when I was a kid, Sheriff John was the local cartoon guy on our TV show.
Oh, I thought maybe it was a guy who came to your house when your dad was found in a ditch or something.
No, he was a guy. He had the Daily Show. I think, and I can't
like
remember.
A Ramblin' Rod.
Yeah,
sort of
a Ramblin' Rod guy, and he was awesome because he was dressed in a sheriff's outfit and anything, and he would show you cartoons and he would teach you manners. And teach you, like, how to drink your milk and that sort of thing. But every day they had a thing where he would read the birthday kids' names, and he sang a song that went along with it that went, put another candle on your birthday cake. We're gonna make a birthday cake. Put another candle on your birthday cake. You're another year old today.
Thank you, Dawn. I appreciate
that.
You're welcome. And in your weekend state as well.
And then there's this whole thing about, I have some ice cream and some something, something too. And I don't remember all those words. But I do remember the basis of it.
Let me ask you this. When you were, did you watch Romper Room when you were a kid?
I did. But the thing is, I remember very little about it because I was really, really small when I watched it. And I graduated onto other things, I think, fairly young.
I would like to know exactly. I'd be curious. There's no way to quantify this. But I'd be curious to know exactly how many children were sort of unnerved or disturbed or traumatized or scarred by the fact that it seemed like What's-Her-Name on Romper Room was looking out at the television and could see you sitting there in your underwear. Because you're in front of the TV and she'd say, like, and I see Tom and Phil and Dave and Dawn.
Yeah.
And it's like you're just sitting there in your plastic pants going, ah, crap, and I just wet myself. What she must think of me.
Well, and Sheriff John was actually, when he left the Metro Media station in L.A., he was replaced by a Hobo Kelly. And she did that same thing. She had some kind of a magic spyglass thing where she would, like, look into the TV and talk to you. And that always just creeped me out.
Her name was Hobo Kelly?
She was Hobo Kelly. She was, she did that whole hobo-y clown kind of a thing.
I was going to ask if she was a clown because otherwise she's just a homeless chick.
Yeah.
That they've put in the room with children.
And she had a song that she sang at the very, because she's a magical hobo clown.
Uh-huh.
And at the beginning, which...
Seems like she could get herself a house if she was that magical.
I think this is more of why I... she replaced Chuck. She didn't replace Sheriff John. She replaced Chucko the birthday clown. But I always remember she had this song at the beginning that she sang when she was ostensibly flying through the air on her way to wherever she showed up to do the show. And she'd sing her song about being a Hobo Kelly. And she'd sing HOBOKELLY. And when she sang B-O, she would, like, lift her arms up in the air in a jaunty fashion, which we kids all thought was hilarious because, you know,
right.
B-O.
Because of the stench.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's a great story, Don.
Is that a good story?
Great story, Gordy.
That cold medicine may be kicking in.
It's the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. It's
503-505-6964 if you'd like to join us today. You can also text via Skype if you like. That is Rick Emerson Show. That's our Skype username. Text box on the website, or you can also email Don Taylor if you like. That is Don, D-A-W-N, at rickemerson.com, D-A-W-N at rickemerson.com, or Rick at rickemerson.com.
Now call, Skype, send in your birthday wishes to Mr. Rick Emerson.
Or, you know.
It's his birthday.
Or not, you know, really, that's your choice as an American. You don't have to. I mean, you have free agency, as the Mormon prophet would say.
It's
you
a festive day.
You're not under any obligation to do that. Don't feel like you got to spread birthday cheer. And I'm not, and it's not like I'm not some guy. I don't dislike my birthday. A lot of people are sort of, especially as they you know, approach advancing age, or as the, you know, as the cruel hand of time comes for them. A lot of people dislike their birthday. I am not. I am not anti-birthday. It's just, to me, it's one of those things that. I always just forget about it. Like, it just creeps up on me. Again, it's not like I try to avoid it or something, and I'm not like I don't have some hang-up about it. I mean, hey, you know, birthdays are... I'm a fan of birthdays like everybody else. I just don't ever really think about it happening until... I think last night I actually forgot about it. I was sitting at home. I mentioned this last hour that my wife was over at, I think, with Jen and Aaron, and she was playing some, you know, like... I don't know. God Killer or God... I don't know, Christ
Ascension
Slayer
5,
game
the Godsmacker.
Something. It was some insane, like, sort of, you know, where she's like, oh, I have to go. I'm being menaced by elves, you know, or whatever. And she, like, had to hang up the phone. But so I was at home just working on some stuff, and then she appeared at the home. And the thing about it is like, I've had a couple of presents that have arrived at, you know, that's like my mom has sent me stuff, and I think, you know, Laura got me a few things. And it's that thing where Laura has been so much, like, I have zero problem waiting until my birthday to open presents. I don't have that whole thing where it's like, I gotta, you know, or my parents had to hide my Christmas presents from me, you know, or it's like I had some sort of a self-control issue with, you know, wanting to open everything on Christmas Eve. I got no problem waiting. So we've had these Christmas presents or these birthday presents just sitting at the house for like 3-4 days, and every day Laura would come home and she'd go, do you want to open your presents today? And I would say, no. And I would go back to typing, and she'd say, why not? I'd say, because it's not my birthday. And then I would just resume, which I think makes me look joyless in some way. But in reality, I just, to me, it's a binary proposition. It is either one's birthday or it is not. If it is not your birthday, you just don't open your presents. So she came up at like 12:02. I just burst in the front door like a brass band playing out of tune. It dragged me out to the living room so that I could open up the stuff that she and my mom got me. So in any event, so... it's all very exciting. Here's what's coming up today. We got your Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, Clown Watch, also Mr. Aaron Duran with Week in Geek. That'll be coming up here in just a few. And did you say that they picked a winner in the Project Mareman contest?
They did indeed.
Because I am reviewing the subjects that Aaron is going to be talking about today for the Week in Geek, and I don't see that listed. Now, I'm not saying that he's not going to... maybe that is a late addition. Did that just happen?
Yeah.
Like moments ago?
Yeah, I just got the press release and email like about 15, 20 minutes ago. So
he may in fact be talking about that. So he's also talking about something that will be of special note to you, Don Taylor.
Yay!
So Aaron Duran with the Week in Geek. Also, Mr. Ryan White, music editor from the Oregonian. He will be in the studio with us later on today. Also, because Rick Emerson is not one to leave himself out of the embarrassment and shame that comes with you know, the turning of the calendar year in terms of one's birthday. Later on today, we will once Ryan is here, we will do today's top five. We will do the top five songs that my parents may, in fact, have been listening to on the Victrola when they engaged in that special act of hugging to create me,
oh,
Rick
that's
Emerson.
Nice.
So we can all be horrified together.
Yeah, that'll be disgusting.
That'll be coming up later on. It's the Rick Emerson program for Monday, brought to you by E.H. Benting. Don Taylor is tracking the following headlines for you on this fine Monday afternoon.
A woman impersonates her dead mother to collect her pension. Northwest University is going to investigate live sex show that happened on campus. And witches cast a spell on Charlie Sheen.
Now, here's the thing about that story is I saw the headline. A guy actually sent this to me on Twitter. He said, let's see, it was a Twitter message. He says, if you haven't already talked about this, please, 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 please do. And he sent it to both you and I.
Yeah.
And I clicked on it, and it just said something like, witches and warlocks upset with Charlie Sheen. Yeah. And I did kind of a little, because it seemed like it was the best thing ever. So I downloaded the whole story. I haven't listened to it yet. Have you? You've listened to it?
Oh, I did. Yeah, I was, and then I actually isolated a couple of clips.
So we've got sound.
I put them in the Dropbox, so there's some sound to go with
Fantastic.
The story.
Fantastic. All right. Is it just as good as I'm imagining it is?
Might not be quite as good as you think it is, but it's delightful.
Are they decidedly exercised about it?
Yes, all yes, right. They are.
That's all I need. Did you watch his Ustream thing?
No, I watched a little bit of it. I tuned in just for a second, and it just looked like him and a couple of guys sitting around yucking it up, and I just decided I wasn't really interested.
The problem with Charlie Sheen's Ustream show is somebody, there was a commenter who really nailed this. They just hit it better than I could. Is that before, like, the whole Charlie Sheen thing was sort of like, you know, when Kanye West was doing those, like, insane meltdowns on Twitter about how he couldn't, like, find a goblet that was encrusted with the right number of rubies. And Charlie Sheen's thing was sort of great in the same way. And then it just became like a bad sports show on cable access. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It just became like, you know, the Chuck and Larry show where a guy was just talking about hockey with some of his douchebag friends. So and here's the other thing, is that then Sheen... It felt like I saw this interview with Dana Carvey years ago where he talked about not wanting to be the church lady at a state fair. You know, just like sitting in a booth going, isn't that special? And then just swigging out of a whiskey bottle. There was this moment during the Ustream thing when Sheen actually, I swear to God, people would just get on the Ustream and they would just type in something, like one of his catchphrases that they wanted him to say, and then it's like he would say it for them. And then he would just sort of move on with whatever was next. And I think that was the nadir. That's when it all just sort of crashed and burned to me.
Yeah, I realized that I unfollowed him on Twitter because I couldn't figure out how to turn off the thing that was sending me a message every time he said something.
Oh, it just goes to your phone every time?
Yeah, I realized I'm paying for those text messages. And why? And then I ended up just unfollowing him on Twitter because over the course of the weekend, it just became that thing of like, you know, it's one thing for a guy to be like really crazy and do entertaining crazy things. And then when they cross that line where it's like, look at me. Everyone's paying attention to how crazy I am. Now I'm going to be deliberately crazy. And it's not nearly as interesting as the sincere crazy.
Right.
So I just was like, okay, now you're just... Now I'm just tired of you.
Except there is an argument to be made that if he's doing it, that, I mean, in other words, now we're totally just going inside our own navel with this. But there is an argument to be made that it's just a further manifestation of his craziness. In other words... If he secretly doesn't believe it to be crazy, but sees that there's, you know, there's money to be made or there's attention to be gotten, by doing this stuff that he does not believe to be crazy, but that he recognizes everybody else does perceive as crazy, then he's still crazy.
Oh, I have no doubt that something else will happen that will delight me sometime, you know, in the near future. But for the moment, I just kind of...
You think for now you're off the Sheen wagon?
I'm off the Sheen for the moment.
All right, okay.
By the way, I got an email here from listener Rhonda. Because I was talking about Sheriff John earlier, and she said, oh my God, did you grow up in San Bernardino County too? Like, no, I grew up in Los Angeles County, but we still had Sheriff John. She said, I watch Sheriff John every day. I even have his autograph. Looking at it today, it appears he was drunk when he wrote it. Hobo Kelly scared me when she called out the names. I thought she could see viewers through the TV. I would hide behind the sofa so she couldn't see me.
See, that's what I'm saying. That is a thing that is universal. There's an entire, not even just one generation, I would imagine multiple generations who lived in fear that, you know, if Ramblin' Rod, Chick on Romper Room, or anybody was just able to peer out of the magical glass teat and see you there in your underpants, which is... That's a uniquely disturbing scenario, I think, if you're a young person. That'll keep you from sleeping soundly at night. All right, it is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. I do have to mention real briefly. I think I just put, did I send a Twitter announcement about this, or did I just plan on it and then I got interrupted by Legion of News? No, I did. This morning we did an Outlook Portland interview with this guy Chris Cerrone. Chris Cerrone is an actor who is best known as playing the young Henry Hill in Goodfellas. And he's done some other movies since then. He's done some TV work and whatever. And he's relocated to Portland, Vancouver. He did an indie film a couple months ago that he was talking about and promoting. Just the coolest guy, and a guy that, you know, sometimes you talk to those guys who have, I don't even want to say it's a singular role, but it's a defining role, or it's a major role early in their career, and, you know, especially in a movie that is just so towering as Goodfellas, and a lot of times that can just give you like a real jaundiced perspective on things, where they have no sense of their own proportion, where either they just, you know, there's a lot of times guys like that who do something will measure every single thing they do and every day they live for the rest of their lives against that role, which is just, I mean, that is just like a one-way road to being disappointed and being embittered your entire life. Or they will look at that one role and decide that that is like that is really all they ever need to do to have a lifetime of entitlement. You know, which leads you down like some equally strange, behavioral path in your life. He's very much in the middle. I mean, he recognizes that it was a great opportunity and a great role, but he's also, you know, he also knows that nobody's going to hand him anything. So he's kind of out there sort of making his bones, as they say, in the music or in the movie industry. But the thing is, he will, you don't really have to push him on it, but if you do ask him, he will answer very honestly about his experiences working on the set of Goodfellas, one of which was, I swear to God, he was shooting the sequence where he and the young Joe Pesci are off blowing up the competing cabs at the taxi stand. Or whatever it is, they're just dropping the Molotovs in and then running away. And there's that great sequence where he runs toward the camera, and then it freeze frames. And I forget exactly what he says. Is that the moment when he says, "As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster"? The cars are lighting up in the background and they're just about ready to all explode? He's talking about filming that sequence, and I'm just talking to this guy this morning and just thinking, like, you know, he's just talking to some guy who. It is just bizarre to think that, like, he lived not just that scene in the shooting of it, but lived the experience he's telling me, where I said, you know, what was it like to be on the set? I said, did you have any sense at the age of, like, 12, 13, of who Martin Scorsese was and who Robert De Niro was? And the fact that you were on the set of a Scorsese film, I mean, you know, based on this notorious real-life mob figure, did you really have any sense of that? And he said that... He said that he did because he had read some of the source material and his parents had sort of, you know, they sort of read up on the real-life Henry Hill as he was getting ready to shoot. But he was telling the story about the night they shot that sequence where Scorsese comes over and he does that thing of calling him, you know, Martin. He goes, well, you know, so I'm on the set and I'm getting ready to shoot. And Martin comes over and asks if there was anything, you know. He's like, is there anything you need? Chris, is there anything you need before we shoot? Are you hungry? You need water, coffee, anything before we go? And he said that he was feeling a little bit hungry. And he's from New York. He's from the neighborhood, as they say. So he just mentioned that he could really go for some cannoli. And he said, but if we don't have any, not a big problem. And, you know, of course, they're shooting in New York. So he said that Scorsese just vanishes for a couple minutes and comes back with a bag of, like, these fresh, like, warm cannoli. And he said you could feel the warmth through the bottom of the bag. And he said, and then Scorsese says, do you mind if I have one? And so he's just there sharing cannoli with Martin Scorsese before getting ready to shoot this sequence in Goodfellas. And I was thinking, God damn, my life sucks. I am the lamest, least interesting person on planet Earth. So,
That'd be, like, the best memory ever.
He showed me a picture of him with Spike Lee and Madonna. So it was all just... It was a day in which everything was put in perspective for me, Don. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. It's 503-505-6964. Don't let me forget, speaking of New York, I got this thing I'll get to in a second that'll... It will amuse you, Don.
Oh, okay.
It'll fill your life with treadles and guffaws aplenty. Mm-hmm. Plus, Oregonian music editor Ryan White going to be with us. Also, we got the Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, and Clown Watch coming up. Without further ado, ladies and gentlefolk. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program from geekinthecity.com. The one and only Mr. Aaron Duran with the Weekend Geek. Hello, sir.
Pew! I like the background music.
What are you doing over there?
I'm good. I can kind of hear my intro in the background really quietly. It's kind of awesome. It makes me want to fly into space.
Yeah, Mego Star Wars. The Mego Star Wars, the disco mix. They have this whole album they put out. I think it's called Music from Beyond the Stars. And most of it is taken up by just that Star Wars song. The Star Wars theme is done in a disco style. But then they also do, I think, Superman. I think they do something from Lost Planet, something from Lost in Space, and... Quite possibly Far Out Space Nuts with Ruth Buzzy and Jim Neighbors, all in a disco style. So,
did they also do a Space 1999 cover? Probably.
No, I don't think so, because I think Space 1999 didn't exist until the 1980s. Don Taylor?
No.
Space 1999, when did that air?
That was the 70s.
Was it the 70s? Yeah. I thought it was very early 80s.
No, I'm pretty sure that was the 70s.
David Walker would know for sure because he was all agog about the recent DVD re-release of that in which they did a brand new transfer from the master films. How was your life on this Monday, my friend?
How's my what?
How was your life on this Monday? How are things?
Things are going pretty good. This is always the second half of my weekend, so my Mondays are generally far more enjoyable than the average person's Mondays.
Let's start off with this news that you had for Don Taylor. Please elaborate upon the...
He made the McRib noise.
The description that you sent to me this morning via text.
Well, I know that Don and I are both just huge Guillermo del Toro fans.
Mm-hmm.
And it has finally been confirmed after years and years of him putting it on the back burner. This June, Guillermo del Toro is going to start filming H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness.
Finally, yes.
God.
Oh, awesome.
I've like seen the props. I've interviewed him before, and I've got to see the props of the creatures he's going to draw in this hidden Antarctic, you know, city that the expedition brings back to Miskatonic University. And I was like, I don't care what else you're doing. Go make this movie. I remember when he got hired, when he was first cast to direct The Hobbit, I remember just being thoroughly annoyed because that meant that it was going to be delayed yet again. So, but in June, they
The thing in my mind's eye, when you said, oh, I've seen the props. I could see you sort of wobbling in your seat like a weeble and then kind of waving little T-Rex arms sort of in excitement, which is probably not too far from the reality.
No, that's pretty much what it is. I just flop my little stumpy digits and like, look at those tentacles and that which man's not meant to know. Woo-hoo!
All right, so somebody has to explain to me what it is that we're talking about here. I mean, I know who H.P. Lovecraft is, obviously, but why all the disproportionate excitement?
In the Mountains of Madness is just one of the great Lovecraft works, and it's just after and Guillermo del Toro is a great creature creator. You know, of course, he started out as a makeup and effects guy. And if you go back to like his movie Kronos, and you look at all of the secondary creatures and stuff that he made for Hellboy, mm-hmm. and I mean, he is the perfect guy to create.
He is the guy to do this.
Yeah, to create a Cthulhu-loid universe.
I'm sorry. Hold on one second. A what?
A Cthulhu-loid universe.
Please. Okay. Is that the universe from which Cthulhu? I thought Cthulhu was just a thing that lived at the bottom of like I don't know, the bottom of a lake or something.
What? A lake can't contain the great and terrible Cthulhu. You ass.
Wow! It's like you just became the booby doctor.
Cthulhu is the death that cannot die. He sleeps and waits under the great city of Riley so he can rise up, Fataga and I.
What he said.
Wow. Was that, is this before or after we rest in the stomach of a great and terrible slorg or whatever the hell?
Little bit afterwards.
You were just,
The shrubs and jewels are roasting the depths of the slore of that day, I can tell you.
Okay. You know what you were? It's not even that you were the booby doctor right now. It's that you were, it's like you were that version of the booby doctor that you played in the Ebenezer I Barely Knew Her. You shock noob. You're totally pwned.
Tell Sarah she's just hot as balls.
Okay. All right.
I have people that still think I am the booby doctor.
Really?
I mean, would that I could be that famous.
I mean, did they think you were doing it like as an undercover, like it was your secret identity?
Exactly. It helps me pick up chicks. You know I'm the booby doctor,
yeah,
right?
Of course. That's exactly how that works.
Yeah.
All right. Well, how nice for you all. what else is going on in the world of geekery, sir? Let's talk bowling.
Yeah. Geek in the City has a Sleep Country pajama ball bowling team as well, but we're not going to be in Vancouver. We're going to be at the Big Owls in Beaverton, so we can't actually duel on the lanes, as it were.
Oh, I see. So we're not even going to be able to face down mano a mano.
If it makes you feel better, you're going to raise an exponential amount more the money than we are ever going to be able to raise. So, you know, that'll help for you guys. There's a good chance we'll be paying for our own donations out of our own pocket. So, for us.
What are you doing? Is this like some sort of a nerd bowling rope-a-dope thing you're doing here? Are you trying to?
Yes, exactly.
You're playing
playing
the game of lowered expectations, so then you can bring the haymaker. I see. I understand.
Yeah.
If people want to donate to the Geek in the City Sleep Country Pajama Bowl team, which is a thing that I posted a blog about this over the weekend, we've done for many years. It benefits local programs for foster kids, so it is the much vaunted good cause that people are often looking for. If people want to donate to that, do they just go to geekinthecity.com?
Yeah, I'm going to put up a link up right later on today. But actually, the best way right now is just go to my Facebook page. Just type in Aaron Duran on Facebook, and the link that'll take you to our Sleep Country team will pop right up. Actually, thanks to Cheryl Kanakoa, who knows how to work the internet way better than I do. I couldn't get our team to show up on any links. I just had to look by names. So Cheryl posted a link on my own page and said, here's how you do it. Idiot.
Well, it's just nice to know that Cheryl finds time in her busy schedule to help our competitors. That's great. Thanks, Cheryl. I appreciate that.
you know, Rick, I like to think that we're doing it all for the kids. I mean, you might want to turn into a contest about yourself, but I'm in it for the kids.
Such a dick. You're such a dick. Die. die covered in ants.
That's right. Thank you.
You know, speaking of being covered in ants, let's talk about methamphetamine for a moment. Now, I don't really know what this means. You just, in the overview of the stuff you were going to be talking about today, you had the bowling, you had the thing with Del Toro, and then you just said comic books for meth or meth for comics, which is,
yes.
I don't know if that's like that Toys for Guns program that they have in L.A., but please to explain the meth comic connection, sir.
I actually just found this morning on The Smoking Gun. It's 30-year-old Colorado resident Aaron Castro apparently is a huge comic book fan in addition to being a massive druggie and meth dealer. And unlike other kind of drug dealers that launder their money through, you know, guns or whores, he thought it was a really good idea to launder all of his money through comic books. So he would take all of his ill-gotten meth money that he would make and then go to his local comic book shop, who knew, by the way, that he made all his money with meth, and then would purchase just stacks and stacks of books. Once he was arrested a few days ago, the authorities realized that he had purchased over $500,000 worth of comics.
Now, was he buying these comic books because he himself was a legitimate collector, or was he buying them and then reselling them later as a way to sort of wash the money?
No, he just wanted the comics. He realized that he wasn't going to be able to get like his weekly collection of, you know, of Avengers and the Justice League, you know, with his little crappy 7-Eleven job. So realized, wait a minute. Meth.
I won't be able to get a silver foil annual edition with this minimum wage job. I need to sell narcotics.
Yeah. So the big thing is, like, obviously he went to jail. He was busted. They are now investigating the comic book shop now as well, because it turns out that the shop kind of had an idea of how he was getting all the money and never reported anything. But the big issue right now is that the authorities don't know, because if you're busted as a drug dealer, they seize all your assets.
Right.
They don't know what to do because they realize that there's absolutely no secondary market for comic books. So even though he spent almost $500,000 in comics, they can't really turn around and sell it for anything. It's worth, you know, $20.
So they have value to him because he is a comic book enthusiast, but to the average person, it's not. Let me just ask you this then. So this is, you actually bring up something that I was going to bring up, I think, on a subsequent episode, but I'll just ask you here. You say that there's no secondary market for comics. So just by and large, I mean, there are exceptions, obviously. I mean, if somebody, you know, somebody has their, like, you know, Detective Comics number, whatever. But if somebody is, you know, out there, you get these guys who buy comic books, so you think they're going to fund their retirement with them. Is that just not the case?
Yeah, they're to be honest, they're being foolish if they think they're going to retire on their comics anymore. When people come into the store, usually with just like a little short box of comics, or they have them, you know, wrapped up in a paper bag, and they say, you know, how much can I get for these? 99.9995% of the time, it's zero. And we kind of tell people that unless you have a comic from pre-1975, the odds of it being worth any more money than what you paid for it originally are slim to none.
Is this because when people buy comics now, they are doing it a lot of times specifically for investment purposes, which means that by definition, the comic ends up not being rare or valuable?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's why any comic from like pre-75 might have some value, is because no one thought to save those comics. No one thought they'd be worth anything. So by default, they become rare and they become collector's items. It got really bad in the early 1990s when it much kind of like we had the stock market, you know, the tech market crash or the housing bubble. In the early 1990s, you had places like DC and Marvel telling thousands and thousands of potential readers that these were going to be collector's items and that they were going to be worth so much money in the future. Well, you can't make, you know, the death of Superman will never be a collector's item when you print 5 million copies.
Right, right.
I mean, even if only half a percentage of the people keep those, that's still 50,000 copies of the death of Superman in circulation. It's never going to be worth any money.
So really, I should just be putting all my investment savings into old copies of Bananas.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know if you still have it, but like your old collection of Mad magazines is probably worth more than someone's entire run of X-Men from like 1980 on.
Well, I don't have most of those, but I'd like to thank you for bringing up such a painful memory.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Hey, and real quick, just sort of related to this, here's something that probably every comic book nerd in the world knows, and I'm just like I'm the last guy who doesn't. So when I was a child, I was not a huge comic reader, but I read like your anthology comics, like your House of Mystery and so forth and your whatnot. So Whenever I was looking for old like House of Mystery comics and I couldn't find them in any of the comic book stores in Kennewick, certainly not there were any places in Kennewick to buy old comics, I would buy them from this magical, mythical, wondrous place that they advertised in the comic book called Mile High Comics. And so what is the deal with Mile High Comics? Is it true that that actually just – that that started – was just like some guy's like single collection that was like the size of a warehouse and then just turned it into a store?
Yeah, pretty much. And it's – yeah, it's right out of Denver. I've never been there before. But yeah, like you, I would flip in the back of a comic and they always took out that one single page that I think showed – if I remember correctly, the picture was a squirrel with like a suit of armor and a sword. And it was, you know, and you would buy, you could buy comics by like the pound, you know, through the mail at Mile High Comics. But from what I've heard is that the guy who owns the place is kind of an a-hole and basically acts like the Walmart of comic book shops. If you try to open a small shop in Denver, apparently he puts out his little message to all his managers for all his shops to cut the prices of everything they have in half, knowing that everyone will then stop shopping at the small mom-and-pop shop, and then he buys their stock and increases his warehouse size.
And then if that doesn't work, the squirrel comes and pays you a visit late at night. And they.
But even if he is a colossal jerk, I, as an old-school comic book fan, I kind of need to check out Mile High Comics once before I die.
It's just one of those things that I would always see referenced. Here's another thing, by the way. The thing that is really just screaming to have a documentary made about it, and I don't understand why nobody has. Somebody needs to do a documentary about the companies that advertised their wares in like those, you know, in comic books. Not just like, I mean, your Charles Atlas, where, you know, you go home and kick the chair before you mail the envelope because you got sand kicked in your face.
Your X-ray specs.
Your X-ray specs. Your Sea Monkeys, of course. Or those things where it's like those things in the back where it's like Commander, like O or whatever, would like have you like annoying your relatives with Christmas cards so you could buy a wristwatch radio. I mean, there was an entire cottage industry, and I would imagine still is. Of just companies that advertised and sold their stuff in the same handful of for example, like, have you ever in your life, Aaron Durant, have you ever known anybody that actually purchased, read, consumed, subscribed to, or knew anything about Grit magazine, apart from the fact that it was some crap they sold in a in a comic book? Has anybody ever seen an issue of Grit?
I remember the ads, but I've never even seen a single issue of Grit magazine.
No, it's one of
never
those.
Never once.
I think it exists, like. It's like one of those fake ads in Games magazine or something. I think it just exists as like a thing to be placeholding text whenever they can't. It's like lorem ipsum text whenever they can't sell like a real ad. And so that is a thing that fascinates me to this day. So one of these, I keep talking about doing this documentary, someday in the great beyond. I keep talking about doing this documentary, which is a series of smaller 10-minute documentaries, sort of a documentary anthology. And that's one of the things that I want to investigate, is those companies that advertised in the back of comic books. And like the X-ray specs, for example, or the 10-in-1 scope, which I did in fact order when I was a small child. Or
I do kind of wonder if a lot of those actually evolved into the As Seen on TV companies.
It might be. I mean, because they must have had a common source for all those things. But at the same time, there had to have been a guy somewhere, probably named Harvey, who invented X-ray specs. Like one day they didn't exist, and the next day they did. Somebody had to invent those. Here's another thing I wonder.
The guy that founded the Correspondence Art School in the back of every comic book?
Exactly. Do you want to know what I would – I'm getting myself all dangerously worked up. I can't have a stroke on my 38th birthday. That would just be dumb. And I can't have a stroke about this, of all things. Do you ever wonder about this? This is the sort of thing that keeps me awake at night, not because I'm wondering just about the thing itself, but then it's like you wonder – then I wonder what the hell is wrong with my stupid brain that I'm miswired to care about things like this. Do you know what fascinates me? I want to find the guy who actually drew the Timmy the Turtle drawing.
Not people
who drew it like to try to get into the school. I want who drew the baseline example of that? Who drew the standard by which all Timmy the Turtles are judged? And where is that guy? And does he have any idea, like, of the cultural currency that his drawing possesses? Or was it just like some guy at Hallmark who dashed it off on his lunch break because he needed $5? I mean, I think about that kind of stuff all the time. Here's one more, and then I swear to God I'll be done. I wonder about this. What is in sneezing / itching powder? And does it kill you?
I don't think it would kill you. It's kind of hard to sell things in comics that kill you.
Dawn?
Not a clue.
I mean, it must be something. Like, it can't just be ground up fiberglass. I can't. Not now.
Well, not anymore.
Maybe in a simpler time. I mean,
not since 1974.
Anyway, I'm just saying that the comic books are an endless source of. Comic books are not unlike computers in that I know a little bit about them, but I am far more interested in the culture surrounding them than I am sometimes in the thing themselves. So well, I don't know a lot about comics, but comic culture fascinates me.
Someday I should come on the show. It'd be like a longer segment, but I could talk on and on about people don't realize I could talk on and on about how during the era of Prohibition, how the mafia kept the comic industry going.
You should definitely talk. We should totally do. Yeah. We should do like a comic book, like a comic book confidential, the history of the comic book volume. Oh my God! We should totally do. This is what we should do.
Zootalores.
I'm sorry. I don't know what is up with me today. The thing is, it's like Dawn at least has the excuse of being high on cough medicine and also having her immune system under attack. I have no such excuse other than I'm old and mentally enfeebled. I was just talking to Aaron the other day. He was here for frontemploymentradio.com, and I was we were talking about comics, and I forget how it even came up. I think we were talking about that documentary called Comic Book Confidential, which is not really all that good. It seems like it's going to be much more promising than it is about the golden age of the comic book. But Aaron was telling me a lot of stuff I didn't know, such as that not only Batman, but Superman at one point actually killed people, that Superman at one point did kill villains, which I never knew. And I said, I really am honestly astounded that some guy like Ken Burns, if not Ken Burns himself, hasn't done like a 10-hour comprehensive documentary of the comic book as an American art form. It really is. You know, my wife, who has almost no comics knowledge, and I don't say that as a knock. She just doesn't. She just finished Cavalier and Clay. And she said, she's like, there's so many questions I have. She's like, there's so much I want to know about the history of comic books, having read The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. And I'm surprised that somebody hasn't done that. We really ought to just take the bull by the horns and do that ourselves. All right, there you go.
I say we do it. Let's go apart. Call Siegfried.
Just crazy enough to work. Yeah. All right, have we Dawn, you said that you have a little bit of breaking nerd news. You didn't know if Aaron had this or not. Let me find the breaking news sounder here. Dawn has just a little bit of something we're going to cover here before we end this. Dawn Taylor?
I have pulled this up here so that I actually have it in front of me so I can pretty correctly. Yes, the winner of Project Mareman has been announced.
Yes, it has.
So, well, there you go. Manny McIver of Portland submitted
his name is McIver?
Yep, McIver.
Oh, okay.
Not McGyver, but McIver.
All right.
Submitted the winning design, earning tickets to Stumptown Comics Fest and a cash prize. His costume, named Sam Droid, will be fabricated by the Alter Ego Society and worn by Mayor Stan Adams on April 16th at the Comics Festival at the Oregon Convention Center.
Now, other than the word droid, which gives some of it away, do we have any, are there specifics of the costume?
Let me take a look. Yes, we do have,
Do we have concept art?
Yes. Here, I will turn this around
so
you can take a look.
All right, so it appears to be sort of a Blue Beetle-type costume crossed with the Blue Beetle meets Boba Fett.
Man, look at you catching the Blue Beetle reference.
That's what I do.
And he has solar power for energy during the day. Coffee power for energy during the night.
Excellent.
His backpack apparently is filled with Stumptown coffee.
All right, so that is so now the Alter Ego Society will fashion that, and then that will be on display at the Stumptown Comics Fest.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. Awesome. So more details on that. Excellent. Anything else, my good friend? Before we draw a curtain down on things for today.
I think that about covers it. We've got Lovecraft bowling and meth for comics. Yeah.
Excellent. Aaron Duran. You can find out more about him and all that he does in his burgeoning geek-oriented empire at geekinthecity.com. That is geekinthecity.com. Thank you, my friend. We will talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Aaron Duran, ladies and gentlefolk. All right. We'll do this. We will come back here in just a skosh with our good friend, Mr. Ryan White from the Oregonian. And, Dawn, I know that you said this once already, but we have a clown watch coming up today. If I'm missing something, Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, Clown Watch.
Yeah, and our Charlie Sheen and the Witches.
All right. That's the other thing. We do have the Charlie Sheen and the Witches sound. So that is all on the way. Let's see. Plus, we'll do today's top five and so forth. Stay right there. The Rick Emerson Show continues momentarily. You are listening to the Emerson News Network. Go nowhere. We return after this.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I'll watch the rain, it settled in, disappeared for days again. Most of us will stay in. Filtered through a million lies, the whole world's got a
That new machine was cheap as hell. Only John would work as well. So they left him laying where he fell the day John Henry died. John Henry was a steel driving bastard. But John Henry was a bastard just the same. Some on the fly. Say your prayers, John Henry Ford, 'cause we don't need your work no more. You should have known the final score the day John Henry died. The day John Henry died.
Listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It is Monday, March 7th, 2011. Still to come today, Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, Clown Watch. We'll also do the top five that's coming up later on. Just a skosh, as they say. Hello, Don Taylor.
Hi.
You looked like you looked as though you were about to say something momentous, world-changing, life-altering, earth-shaking.
Probably not.
Okay, let me just say this. According to somebody who could just be making this up, but who identifies himself as Warlock with two exclamation marks. Mm. Itching powder, as sold and advertised in the back of comic books, is in fact made of, anyone? Pig's hair.
Huh.
I don't know whether it's just actual pig's hairs or whether it is pig's hair that has been then ground or reduced. Or
I can see that, though, because pigs do have very, very coarse, bristly hair. So if you, like, it'd be like taking emptying all the stuff out of your razor into an envelope and then putting it down someone's back. It'd be like that. That would make you itch.
Let me just tell you this. I've never really had razor hair put down my back, but there was that incident a few months back where I inadvertently drank that glass full of beard shavings. So that was no good. It was all worth it. Even the actual incident of drinking them, it was worth it just for the look on Ryan White's face just now. It's walking out of the Rick Emerson Radio Program for the Oregonian music editor and stylish man of the world, Ryan White.
But
this
by the
why
way,
I'm afraid to shave.
I did want to mention Glass Full of Beard Shavings is the name of my indie folk album.
Well done. Hello, Ryan White. How are you?
We had a tour with my band, Gandhi's Pimp Hand.
It's a true story, by the way. I was going to ask, how do you shave? Clearly, the answer is not at all or badly. You've got a full-on, I mean,
it's not good. It's out of control.
It's not just beard.
We're getting into Cat Stevens territory here.
Yeah.
I
got a flight in like a month and a half, so I got to get rid of this thing before then, or I'm never getting through security.
It really is. Is it the sort of beard that almost you assume that somebody is working on? They've either placed a wager with somebody, or they have some sort of large project in the works, and the completion of which will be the point at which they can shave. Like that's the thing. Like, I hate to immediately go to this, but did you ever look at the Facebook photos of Peter Carlin?
Oh, no.
Isn't he slowly morphing into various Springsteen album covers?
See, that's my thing. But is it in... But see, I wondered... I was going to make that observation, and I thought, well, maybe I'm late to the party.
Like he's gotten to the river.
I was... What did I tell Don Friday? I said, well, he looks like he's sort of darkness on the edge of town Springsteen. What is up with that? But I was going to say something like that, but I thought maybe I was late to the party, and that, of course, and that was, in point of fact, what he was doing.
No, we've all been... I don't know. We've all been talking around it. Like, I'm supposed to... We were talking about getting, like, the families together for dinner in a couple of weeks. If I show up and he's got a red baseball cap in his back pocket.
Yeah. I mean, it's very.
Yeah, he's definitely doing a Springsteen thing with this hair in his current.
I like that he's clearly in a Marriott, too. You can just tell by the furniture in the background.
Well, that's what most of your best folk songs are about. They're about your upscale chain hotels, with the kitchenette. So your beard though is really, I mean, it's substantial. You're aggressively bearded. Is this just because you've got the kid, and so therefore it's like beard shaving the beard or trimming it or whatever has fallen so low in the priority list that just
yeah. Pretty much. I mean, it's going now. It's like I want to get rid of it, but it's going to take so much work to chop this thing off. Now I'm just putting it off, and you know, as I said in the break, now we're to the point that my mom's getting in Thursday night, and so I kind of just want to freak her out with that. Now it's also something very nice for my daughter to pull on.
Well, this is when you do something like you go to Bishop's and you get like an attractive young barberess to do the whole chopping.
I don't trust straight razors
stuff like that.
Well, see, but that was
I saw that musical.
That was going to be my question, actually. So you're not just the stubble or the bristly face. Like you've got the full on beard, and you're like Elvis Costello that one time he showed up on SNL and he just looked like he was driving logs long haul somewhere. But if you were to shave, I mean, this sounds dumb, but how do you shave that off? You can't just use like an electric razor.
No,
what
you
do they do?
You got to cut it down first.
They go with scissors or something.
That's all I've got right now. I might go get a beard trimmer.
Or clippers to the skin, and then
you should do that.
You should really get the PDXR guys to like do you up as a pirate before you get rid of the beard.
Hey, now get some
pirate photos of yourself.
That's the thing, because then they could bead it for you. That's what I'm saying right there. And you get a little, and then you could fork it at the bottom.
Ooh,
I'm just saying.
Wanted a forked beard. You know, I've let this go like this badly once before, and my wife and I were flying back to Columbus, Ohio, and it's like, you know, you joke about airline security, but so we were late for the flight, and we go rushing through security, and I get stopped for extra screening,
of
and
course.
she doesn't see that I have been stopped for extra screening, so she grabs not only like my bag. But she grabs my flip-flops that were in the container and takes off running to the gate. She thought that I had just left all of this stuff and gone running to the gate. And I'm left standing there, and I'm like, I finally call her, and I'm like, where are you? And she's like, I'm at the gate. Where are you? Like, do you have my shoes? Yeah, and now, you know, we're like 5 minutes to take off. I'm running through the airport barefoot with this, like, ridiculous beard. And, like, everybody's just looking at me like, that I did not get tackled by security and just beaten is...
It's like Jesus as O.J. Simpson. Here's the question I have. You know, I was just thinking about flying, actually, because I'm going to be flying next week. And there's that whole thing about, you know, do not let persons unknown to you, you know, handle or observe your luggage. And it just seems like one of those things that, like, where is that line of demarcation for, like, when is someone unknown to you? Like, if you share a 12-hour plane ride with somebody and you talk about, like, you know, what restaurants do you like and what color, what school do your kids go to and what do you do for a living and what did you really want to be when you grew up and what is your favorite ABBA record? Is that then a person you can trust with your luggage, or is it simply a matter of – what if it's a person you've known for a long time but you have nothing in common with them and try to avoid them at all turns, like a member of your family?
Well, I guess I've always wondered, what do they do if you say yes? Like you're checking in, like they say, you know, is anybody like not known to you, whatever, done anything? It's like, well, actually, yeah. About a half an hour ago, I left my bag with this complete stranger, and he was fiddling around in it looking for something. What do? Do they actually just hustle it off to security and shunt you aside and hold everything up and then you miss your flight?
I will tell you this. I've never seen that happen as such, but I was at PDX. I was flying out of PDX, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago. I forget where I was going. But there was a guy who, I mean, you could say like, well, you know, you ought to know better. But I mean, it's you know, it's one of those things for most of our lives we flew without having to do any of this crap. So he probably just didn't think about it. He got up and went to the bathroom and left his bag behind. And I mean, you know, it was going to the bathroom, you know, I don't know, maybe he was in there a long time or maybe he went to get the sandwich or something, but the bag just stayed there. And it was. And after a while, it was the creepiest thing, actually. I felt like Suzanne Plachet in The Birds, like where she looks over at the playground and there's one bird and then she looks back and there's 50 and then she looks back and it's covered and, you know, and then there's the, you know, nah, nah, nah. And then they just peck out her eyes. So the guy went off to use the bathroom or whatever and the bag sits there. And I kind of thought, that's weird. And then I looked up later and there was a guy from airport security sort of dressed in black, sort of not doing anything, but visible across the sort of walkway, like maybe however, you know, 50 feet away or something, sort of just standing there stationary. And then I looked up a few minutes later and there was two guys. And then there were four guys like on sort of flanking across the horizon. And then they came in. I swear to God. And then they just sort of circled the bag like the bag itself was going to obtain self-awareness and sprout legs and walk away. And I felt it was really awkward because they waited there for the guy to come back. And the guy came back and, you know, and he did, of course, you know, you come back and there's four guys in black from the security department of the airport surrounding your bag. And
he's
it's
like, I don't need my luggage.
And he had like a mouthful of sandwich and he was just obviously just some, you know, just some guy. And he's just like, is there a problem? You know, and it is, and, you know, and it was like a lot of like, is this your bag? How long did you leave it? Why did you leave it? Let me see your ID. You know, do you have a passport? And the next thing I saw was they took that guy, and I don't think anything bad happened to him as such other than missing his flight. But the next thing I know was like the guy was picking up his bag and he was walking away with those guys and we didn't see him again. So he, at the very least, missed his flight. And depending on
for being that kind of an idiot, you should.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a thing I would do, but, you know, it's just
numerous
strange.
Reasons.
Yeah, it's just strange. It's a thing I don't think I'd ever seen before. I think that's the only time I've ever seen that policy actually put into action, though, where they would, you know, where they really would, like, give you a bunch of, you know,
it's kind of strange, because you think about it, because it wasn't really that long ago that you could be at the airport and you're waiting for your flight and you're sitting there and you're talking to someone and they're like these perfectly nice, you know, middle class couple or something. And after you talk to them for about a half an hour, you're like, I'm going to go to the restroom. Would you keep an eye?
Would you watch this?
Would you keep an eye on my carry on? And they'd be like, OK. And then you'd go and then you'd come back and be fine. And it's like now it would be like, no. No, I cannot take. I cannot keep an eye on your carry-on.
Well, especially because, like, I mean, what do they think is going to happen to the bag while you're gone? I mean, what do they think that's going to be put in there? Because for something to be put in the bag, that means that by definition, whatever's going to be put in the bag that wasn't originally there has to have already gotten through security, which means putting it in somebody else's bag is sort of pointless. I mean. There's no need for me to stick something in your – like if I have a bomb in my pocket and I put it in your bag, that means I got through security with the bomb. And, you know, I'm adding an additional step there, making too much work for myself. Just doesn't make it – logically, the whole thing makes no sense. There's just the underpinnings of these things never – they never support even the slightest scrutiny in my experience.
Yes.
The end. Well, before we do anything else, I have
end
sort of a
there.
Scene. I have a related subject to discuss here in a second. Before we do that, I should ask you, Ryan White, what is coming up in the Oregonian? What's up in the world of music, sir?
Oh, we're working on a couple of things. We I just put a story up online. There's a 58-year-old musician in Salem, Stan McMahon, who last year put out his first ever album.
McMahon is the best name ever. Please tell me that's his real name.
I believe it is.
Awesome.
I have no reason to believe that it isn't. But he has a song. He has a song that's been placed in Jersey Shore this week.
Really?
So, yes. A show he's never seen and will watch hesitantly.
That's sort of the good news,
Thursday
bad
night,
news, I
anyways.
Guess.
So we found that kind of entertaining.
Set to some slow-mo sequence of a guy vomiting into a curb.
As he pointed out, he goes, you know, I'm 58 years old. I'm not 22 years old in Snooki, who I guess is on the cover of Rolling Stone this week. I was like, yeah, you're like 1 degree removed from the cover of Rolling Stone.
It's so weird. We actually have a... I probably shouldn't name who it is, but there's a friend of the show who does some film work every now and again and was tasked with following the Jersey Shore guys around because they were in Portland, actually, not too long ago. It was however many, I don't know, like maybe 6 weeks ago, something like that. But he was sort of tasked with following Snooki and Skitchy and Skeezy and whoever, you know, some of the guys from Dumbo from the Jersey
Seven
Shore.
Orange Dwarfs.
And I said, well,
the
what?
Perpetuation or whatever his name is.
I said, well, what were they like? What was it like? What were they actually doing in Portland? Like, you don't really think of the Jersey Shore guys who've been here. And he said, I swear to God, he said they were speaking at a First Amendment forum. Which,
sure.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, the sort of, the, I mean, maybe that is the First Amendment in action, though. I mean, really, when you think about it, that is sort of meta, you know.
Well, Snooki is a best-selling author.
You know, here's the thing about her. She's one of those chicks where I can't quite figure out if she's attractive or not.
You can't figure that out?
She's not.
Really?
I know that the exterior of her that I see now is not attractive.
No.
But at the same time, but also that's all fake. So, like, maybe underneath she looks totally different.
Well, that's the thing is that's her all tarted up trying to make it look good.
I think it's the orange skin, though, that's the off-put there. So I think maybe if she didn't look like an Oompa Loompa, I might find her. If she looked less like she was, you know, like maybe a Morlock or something.
No.
I mean, it's just, it's so bizarre.
She's pretty much horrible in every single way.
Yeah. I mean, so I would think, but, you know, Rick Emerson tries to find a little good in everybody.
Cover a Rolling Stone subtle. She's riding a rocket.
Yeah. So.
What?
Her photo on the cover of Rolling Stone, which is different from the inside where, no, she
I thought you were joking about that.
She is on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Really?
On the inside, there's a photo of her in a barrel eating a pickle.
As Henry Rollins once said, the good news there is that means whatever time you spent caring about Rolling Stone can now be put towards something productive.
Exactly. Yeah. So there's that. One other thing which is interesting. The Slants, this local band, Asian Americans play dance rock. They can't get their name trademarked. They keep getting rejected by the trademark commission. So I'm currently wading through 180 pages of U.S. Patent and Trademark Office filings.
Is it because it's believed to be because it's a slur or something?
Yes, but what's interesting is I just did a random search this morning, and like 3 years ago, NWA was able to re-up its.
Yeah, well, and you got the porn companies, right. You know, trademark any number of things and products.
So it's an interesting little legal story.
That is interesting.
Among the reasons why they were told that they couldn't the evidence that was listed in the rejection was the UrbanDictionary.com definition of
wow, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Couple of random internet postings.
It is the Rick Emerson radio program still to come today. Taser Watch, Corpse Watch, Clown Watch. Ladies and gentlemen, will you please give your full attention to.
Yes.
I was waiting for you to get the crisp, clean, refreshing. There you go. Dawn Taylor. How was your visa?
And now,
it's delicious.
From the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Northwestern University officials have pledged to get to the bottom of an incident that took place earlier this week involving a popular human sexuality course and a device called the F-Saw. Although it's not F, it's the actual.
Oh, is
word.
That the thing where it's like the pneumatic?
I believe so,
yeah.
Yes. During an optional after-class presentation on campus, Professor John Michael Bailey, a 21-year veteran of Northwestern's psychology department, allowed a guest lecturer to give a live demonstration of the instrument when a video depicting female orgasm was not considered realistic enough.
So this is like a skill saw, but the better description of it is it's almost like a jackhammer that is being held horizontally, and the end of it is a phallus.
Something like that,
yeah. And it just goes in and out like a billion times a minute.
Something like that, yeah. Ken Melvoin-Berg asked the audience if they were, quote, ready for a live sex show. And with 120 people watching, called up two paid performers to enlighten the crowd.
It's like a Hank Williams Jr. knockoff song. Are you ready for an F-Saw?
According to the Daily Northwestern newspaper, a naked non-student woman was repeatedly sexually stimulated to the point of orgasm. Melvoin-Berg doesn't get what the big deal is, but distressed university administrators have launched an investigation into the matter, and in a statement released today, the president of Northwestern said the incident reflected extremely poor judgment on the part of our faculty member.
Naked non-student woman sounds like the least and most exciting superhero ever, like all at once.
Or just like a really bad, like one-line role in a movie.
She couldn't have even said she was just trying to pay her way through college.
I mean, what was the... So this is a human sexuality class?
Yeah. A human sexuality course, and apparently the teacher believed that the video depicting female orgasm was not good enough. Frankly, he wanted them to see an actual female orgasm in action. So,
well, what does it say about? I mean, I think do we know if he's married? Because it says an awful lot about this guy if he thinks that the only way to provide a female orgasm is to have her hump a lawnmower.
I really don't know. It just says that he is a 21-year veteran of the psychology department at Northwestern.
I wonder if that's what tenure does to you, if you just have the idea of just like, well, let's see what else they'll let me get away with. Because, yeah. I mean, that's the thing where you pretty much become – you're more or less like the Pope. You're just irremovable at that point, although I guess we'll find out.
Well, one 21-year-old senior told the Chicago Tribune, it's probably something I will remember the rest of my life. I can't say that about my Econ 202 class and the material that I learned there.
Probably not. So did somebody complain about it, or is it just that, like, someone found out? Because, you know, that's the thing where people tell people.
I think it's just the finding out about it may have alarmed some of the administrators at the college.
I am amazed that video of that somehow hasn't made it onto the internet, though, because you got to figure every kid in there has got a cell phone.
You'd think.
And, I mean, it's like they're just,
I'd at least like to see a compilation of the status updates on Facebook.
Jerry's a dude. You will not effing believe this.
There's a reason there ended up 120 people in the class for the demonstration, I think.
I mean, my whole thing is like, that many people never go to an optional anything
no,
in college.
No.
Like, how. I want to know how all the different connections were made there. Like, how is it that he discovered the woman who was on the receiving end? Like, where did she come from? Where did the saw itself come from? Because I don't think that's a thing you can just buy, like, at your normal, your normal porn store or whatever. I mean, that's pretty much like a Bob Vila project you got to, like, make over the course of the winter, I think. So, like, from where did all these people come? Did he put up a Craigslist ad?
He teaches a human sexuality course. He probably knows other people who are in the realm of human sexuality teachings and recreational enjoyments thereof.
I guess. I mean, maybe it probably in some way does have to do with the fact that it's a male teacher. Because
I mean, hell, I could find somebody. It would.
You want a toe? I can get you a toe.
Inside of 36 hours, I could probably hook you up with somebody who would come like demonstrate one of those things.
I'm not saying it can't be done. I'm just saying that I wonder exactly how it is. I guess he is a human sexuality professor, but at the same time, you think he's a professor, so you know. Maybe he lives in a bit of an ivory tower. I picture him, of course, you know, having a tweed jacket and maybe brewing a strong pot of tea as his afternoon excitement.
Just with no pants.
Yeah, and so I'm just picturing him like skulking down an alley, just wondering if anybody, you know, looking for some, you know, like trolling like Diogenes, but looking for a Sibian or something. So, you know, but what do I know?
Walks into the shop, loosens his bow tie.
I mean,
be willing to.
Where was this at?
Northwestern University.
Which is where?
Evanston, Illinois.
Okay, well,
thank you very much.
See, so this is, I mean, like, if it was a thing, like, if Susie Bright was doing this somewhere, I guess it would probably not be a story. It probably is a story because maybe in Illinois they don't get much of that around there.
It's suburban Chicago.
Yeah, so, all right, here's Don Taylor.
Let's do our Taser Watch.
Here's your Taser Watch for Monday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don Taylor.
Officers came to the rescue of a Florida man reportedly being punched.
I'm sorry, where?
Florida. Reportedly being punched by two others, but ended up tasing him. The incident happened January 21st outside Viking Food Mart, according to the Fort Walton Beach Police Department. Customers saw a black man in an orange shirt being punched by two black men in black shirts outside the store. He said he was afraid to enter the store because of the fight in progress. Officers found the group of men standing near the payphones and pulled each of them aside to question them. During the interview, the 33-year-old man in orange stepped closer and closer to the police officer. As he got closer, the man became more aggressive and yelled at him. According to the officer in his arrest report, the defendant appeared to be intoxicated, as evidenced by the moderate odor of alcoholic beverage coming from his person, his red, watery eyes, and his irrational behavior. Officers ended the other interviews to help with the yelling man. He was placed in handcuffs, but started tensing his muscles and trying to pull away from officers. The report said the man became dead weight as the officers led him to the patrol car. When the man and the officers reached the car, he resisted again by tensing his muscles and pushing upward, at which point the defendant was taken to the ground. As he continued to try and push up off the ground to get away from officers, a sergeant and an officer tried to place him in the patrol car. Didn't work. Man was ordered to sit down. He said, "You can't tell me what to do." And that's when he got the taser.
Awesome. Here's the thing. I think that there ought to be some sort of, well, we've talked before about I think was it an Onion story where they were talking about having a taser with a miniature camera in the front so you could just get a sort of like boop, 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 boop view, like a POV as it sort of goes in. But taser is at the very least, there ought to be like a taser camera, a dashboard camera, something that is triggered because otherwise, you know, I know the argument is that we will then just become an even more voyeuristic society and police won't be able to conduct their jobs appropriately if, you know, people are feeling that they're going to be showing off for the camera or whatever. But the camera ought to just be triggered by certain phrases like, you know, you can't make me, you know, up yours, you can't tell me what to do, pig, you know, and just any one of the, just so the, you know.
They don't even have to pull the trigger.
Yeah, the camera hears that and the camera just goes on because at that point, I think that that's a guy who's, I believe the legal justification is begging for it. You know, and then it's a little free entertainment for the rest of us. Also this, let me ask you, how difficult do you think it would be? I should ask Joe Squires this the next time he's in the studio. I was just thinking, How awesome would it be to just have like a Taze hand implanted? And it wouldn't even need to take off the whole hand. You could just maybe run some sort of tasing cables. You have the bat, like you have the power source maybe on your like a sort of bat utility belt, and then the tasing cables actually just are maybe right underneath the epidermis, not like an implantable patch or you know the implantable birth control device, and then just right to the fingertips where you could either touch a guy or you could just actually like just shoot the tasers from your fingertips.
So you're kind of like Spider-Man only with tasers.
Yes, exactly. It's like sort of like Spider-Man, sort of like Wolverine, sort of like. Help me! Isn't there an electrical? Isn't there a superhero who shoots bolts of electricity?
I'm sure there.
Or sort of like Emperor Palpatine, but you're not. But you're a little bit of each, but you know, not all of either.
See, I would want a stun gun hand, not a taser hand, because the taser, you know, you actually have to shoot the things out into the barbs, and then you have to get them back in. With a stun gun hand, you just have to touch them with two of your fingers and make the contact.
It also seems though, like every time you went to shake your fist at an evildoer, you'd probably tase yourself though if you had just had a stun gun hand.
I would tase myself accidentally all the time.
You just sort of go, "Damn you!" Ah, you know.
I could just poke myself in the eye eating cereal, so yeah. I should not. Be allowed to have a taser hand.
Let me ask you another question that is prompted by the answering of the first question, which is the idea of having a taser that shoots out of your hand. And you said that you would rather have the stun gun.
Mm-hmm.
The thing about it is that, like, if you had a taser hand where you could actually shoot them across the room, mm-hmm. Has anyone else in this room ever thought about that or imagined it? Anyone?
No.
Just shooting someone across the room with my hand?
Okay. Well, I'm just saying. This is what I think about
shooting people all the time in many different forms.
Shooting them a smile.
That, yes, exactly.
Okay. But, you know, you think, well, that's going to be uncomfortable because if you tase a big guy and then he's running away, then you're being dragged behind the guy by your taser hand.
Right.
When you're watching the Spider-Man films, do you reflexively go, ooh, ah, at the idea that that he has the genetic web shooters as opposed to the mechanical web shooters, and that it's probably got a lot of put tension on your wrists, must hurt a little bit when you're swinging off a building?
I hadn't really thought about it, but now that you mention it, why yes.
That's a thing. I know this makes me sound weird. I find it difficult, if not impossible, to watch extended action sequences in the Spider-Man films where he's doing the web and then swinging a building or like holding a train, because it just feels like that would – it seems like that would just be like someone pulling out one of your tendons, you know?
But he does have like insane spider strength, so it doesn't hurt him.
I don't really know that –
I mean, heck, he stopped a train with his feet.
Well, okay. There is that. All right. Well, fair enough. And so forth. There's your Taser Watch for Monday.
Ryan White and I are over here shooting things with our webs.
Good. I was just reflecting on the many, many report cards I got growing up. They said, Richard seems to dwell in his own world. By the way, somebody has already answered this. They said the question, of course, is you just the answer to this is you just web sling a little slack and then you hold on to the slack. Yeah. So you're not actually – so the point of tensile strength doesn't really necessarily be at the point of connection. It is that he is slinging and then wrapping his hand around it. And that's – so he's holding on to it. It is not tethered onto him. So that means that inside his web-spinning doohickey that he's got like some sort of – he's got some sort of miniaturized web equivalent of that thing they use in the school office to cut construction paper, that thing.
So yeah. Now here's my question is because, again, with Peter Parker in the Spider-Man movies, it's a physiological thing.
Right.
Which, you know, in the first movie, it was actually his discovering he had it was this ha-ha akin to some sort of nocturnal emissions kind of a thing. So did anybody else find it creepy in, like, the last movie when at the end of the movie he and Mary Jane are lounging in a giant hammock that he has made out of his spider webbing?
Well, I suppose. I mean,
I saw that and I just kind of went, ew.
It's all relative.
Ew.
I mean, it's like if you can accept Shia LaBeouf humping Megan Fox on top of a living being, I mean, You know, Bumblebee is basically just, you know, is performing some sort of human sex swing, you know, for two spindly people to
I can't accept anything about those movies, so.
I'm just, you know, I mean, so I guess you can't, as Flavor Flav would say, you can't put too much science on that, Don.
No, I just, as soon as I saw, I just imagined him, because the scene before that, before we showed up, would have him been going splurt, 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 and squirting the stuff out of his wrist so that he and Mary Jane could, like, lounge about in it. That's disgusting.
Okay. What would you like me to do about it, Don?
I don't know.
How would you like me to remedy the unease that you feel?
Maybe we should just move on to something else.
You two should clearly never watch Spider-Man together.
Let me just take a brief moment here to talk about Squire's Electric. Just because now it's become sort of a reverse Pavlovian thing, that whenever we talk about something hideous or horrid or off-putting or strange or unease-inducing, then it's like I just hear the sponsor music in my head. This is brought to you by Squire's Electric. Because let's be honest, we don't know how anything works. I mean, at all, ever, under any circumstances. You can contact Squire's Electric at 503-252-1609. Here's another thing about that. Correct me if I'm wrong, but... In both the comic book version and the movie version of the Spider-Man origin story, he is bitten by a radioactive spider. This isn't like the Hulk where they change it for the, you know, for the comic or the TV show or the movie or whatever. It's the same basically in all the versions of Spider-Man.
Right.
So, is that just? I mean, is it a spider with just like? Is it a lab with just one spider in it? In other words, is that spider an accidental? But it's not an accidental byproduct. They actually say at one point, like, "Look at this spider. It's amazing," right?
Hmm.
Like, yes. Isn't he touring a lab where they do nothing but screw with the DNA of spiders?
I believe so, yes. I don't remember the exact details.
Doesn't it seem like that's a superpower, then, that a lot of people would have?
Well...
Like, did they just never notice?
They just...
Test it on anything?
They just... I believe the whole point was they try to keep the genetically modified spiders, you know, safe and in a box, and they don't let them out. And the one that actually got out bit Peter Parker, and that's what happened.
Wouldn't they have noticed that, like, I don't know... That, like, the lab mice were slinging their way around the lab when they came in this morning? I mean, the spiders must...
The spider didn't have super spider powers. The spider was just a spider. It was the radioactive spider mixing with Peter Parker's DNA.
Okay, Rick Emerson understands this, but what I'm saying is, why would you create a radioactive spider and then never test it on anything?
Maybe they did. Maybe the radioactive spider, all it did was just sort of glow or something. It was only when it bit Peter Parker that it morphed into something grotesque and ungodly.
But I'm saying, wouldn't it have been... In other words, if you're going to have a spider in a lab, you got to feed it something, or you're going to see how it reacts in a normal situation against a predator, or perhaps a much larger predator. It seems like it would... In other words, it seems like it would have morphed something before it got to Peter Parker, like a rat.
So in your world of science, we do experiments on animals, and then we put them into cages and make them battle each other.
Yes, my world of science is Japan. So that really does explain that. I'm just saying, if you were a scientist who created the spider, and it's not like they didn't know it existed, and the spider existed, and you're not superhuman, but you know what I mean. If the spider exhibited exponentially greater strength, as a scientist, you would want to see exactly how strong the spider had become. The only way to do that is by pitting the spider against something larger than its normal foe. At a certain point, you will get to something substantially larger, and the spider won't kill it, but the spider will, in fact, mutate it like it did to Peter Parker, thus resulting in a mutated rat, mouse, whatever.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is that maybe the spider did not show exponentially larger strength. It just had... I mean, spiders are very, very strong for their size. That's the whole point of Peter Parker having spider strength, is he has amazing strength for his size, much like an ant or a spider does.
So you're saying the spider may have been viewed as a failure. They may have looked at the spider and said, we zapped it with all the stuff and nothing happened. We're going to incinerate them tomorrow.
Exactly.
And then, right beforehand, it bites Peter Parker.
I blame the media. Okay. Spider goat doesn't sell papers.
So, I mean, you know. Maybe this is just maybe I'm looking at it from the wrong side of the perspective.
Nobody ever talks about the goat.
Well, in any event, Squire's Electric. I was going to say they can't answer any of these questions, but who am I to say? I mean, really, I don't know that for really. You'll have to find out your own self.
Joe Squires does know about a lot of things.
Okay, and somebody says you wouldn't have spider rats because the spiders would have eaten them. They weren't testing the spider had superpowers. They were testing other aspects of the genetic effects of the radiation. Parker's powers were a side effect. It was an unknown. There you go. See, that's why I put it out to the people, because they know. The people, It is, you know, distributed computing by which all knowledge is available to us. You can contact Squires Electric. They're the electrical part of that distributed knowledge. You can find them at 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. Squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. Whether you're upgrading your the wiring in your home, if you're going to be moving into a new place, if you're going to be getting the inspection done at your place of business, if you're going to be expanding your place of business, if you're going to be getting a home office, if you're going to be remodeling, if you're going to be upgrading or augmenting, whether your actual electricity and the wires that contain it, or whether it's your broadband access, your Ethernet, your intercom wiring, anything like that, don't just go jabbing a bunch of tools into a wall, because that's going to end poorly for you, and it's going to take up some considerable time on the part of your next of kin. So you contact Squires Electric at squireselectric.com or 503-252-1609. 503-252-1609. At the news desk, it is Don Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
Don, do we have a little bit of breaking news?
I wasn't going to call it breaking, but we
Don,
have...
do we have a little bit of breaking
sure,
news?
Sure, breaking news.
Thank you. There we go.
Breaking news.
Breaking news from Don Taylor.
A local group of witches cast a spell on...
Oh, this is totally not the news I was talking
no,
about.
No, you said... I thought this was the one you wanted.
Is there actually... There's more break... Hold on, I'll do
oh,
it.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Hold on. Rick Emerson in the back. Thank you. Here's some breaking news.
Oh, you tell us.
This just in. This is by Gary Levin, USA Today. He's not winning anymore. Charlie Sheen has been fired from his starring role in 2.5 Men... 2 weeks after the actor unleashed a torrent of venom aimed at his employers, and specifically the show's producer, Chuck Lorre, in a series of rambling, incoherent interviews. After careful consideration, Warner Brothers Television has terminated Charlie Sheen's services on 2.5 Men, effective immediately, the studio said in a brief statement issued about 12 minutes ago. Spokesman added that no decision had been made on the future of the series, which abruptly wrapped its eighth season February 14th when production was shut down. Attention now moves to whether he'll be replaced and if the show will enter a ninth season, which has already been sold into syndication. So he had been put on suspension, indefinite leave. Charlie Sheen now officially terminated by 2.5 Men. Thank you to Cheryl Kanakoa for sending us.
And in further breaking news on that front, Sheen has already responded.
Awesome.
With a statement to TMZ, in which he calls the termination very good news and says, "They continue to be in breach, like so many whales. It is a big day of gladness at the Sober Valley Lodge, because now I can take all of their bazillions, never have to look at what's his expletive again, and I never have to put on those silly shirts for as long as this warlock exists in the terrestrial dimension."
I don't even know where to begin here. First of all, when he says that they're in breach, like what? Like so many whales?
Like so many whales.
Is that a thing that whales do?
Sure.
When I know babies can breach. I didn't know that whales did that.
Wouldn't that just be when they come up to breathe?
I thought that was when
is
they break
it?
The surface, or is
Maybe
it they breach it. The surface? Or is that broach? Or are they the same thing?
I don't... Yeah.
Is breaching and broaching, is that like chomp and champ?
I don't know.
Oh my God. Yeah. This is...
Where's an editor when you need one?
Seriously, this is just like an endless...
These are actually the things that we discuss for 7 hours at a time in the newsroom, which is why we're incapable of actual conspiracy.
Well, not just you, my
breach
friend.
Breach is the act or result of breaking, break, or rupture.
So to breach the surface of the water, that is a thing that whales do, I guess, in a pod of some kind. Okay, fair enough. All right. Also, he's still a warlock?
Yeah, apparently he's still a warlock.
Okay.
Which leads us to our next story. Oh. A local group of witches cast a spell on actor Charlie Sheen in Salem on Sunday because they're angry at him for
besmirching the good name of witches and
warlocks. Here, the group cast a magical binding spell on Sheen.
Come forth from the dark.
So mote it be.
I bind you, Charlie Sheen.
Was this just like another Sunday at the Horse Brass?
Yeah, this actually, I said local, local to Salem, Massachusetts, which would explain the accent when you hear at the end when she says, "Charlie Sheen."
I just heard like,
just enforcing stereotypes there.
All I heard was the accent. I just heard the patois of drama class.
Yeah.
That's all I heard.
Apparently, witches across the country are angry at the actor for mocking their beliefs and calling himself a warlock. Here, a member of this particular coven explains it.
We heard Charlie using and misrepresenting the words of witchcraft, and it annoyed us.
Now we wanted to heal that bothered us even more. So that's what we did today at 3 o'clock in the hour of the sun. We tried to raise the energy in behalf of his life.
That's enough. Now go conjure me up some chowder.
So, yeah, according to the group, the binding spell is meant to suppress the dark forces affecting Charlie Sheen's soul.
I didn't hear – I couldn't understand a single thing she said, so I'm glad you're sort of translating here. It was just a lot of weird angular A's from where I was sitting.
I just like the beginning where it was a whole thing about summoning something and a moat on something, and then they end with, Charlie Sheen!
Come forth from the dark!
From the dark.
So mote it be.
So mote it be.
I bind you, Charlie Sheen.
And then I have this sounds like the female version of that Billy Crystal character from The Princess Bride.
Damn. You know that Lipinski boy?
In the class.
He's a doctor. Why don't you make me proud? God damn, this is a world full. I typically don't get on the whole, like, this is why the rest of the world, you know, hates this thing. You really have to just step back occasionally and wonder what the rest of the world. Leaving aside whether they hate us or not, just what they think of us when they just sort of look up at the big jumbotron of life and they just see what's going on in the
don't
United States.
Don't they think
States.
We're there, Charlie Sheen?
That probably is it.
Oh, look at crazy America.
I mean, you know, we're just we must just be a source of amusement / frustration to everyone else. I mean, like on a regular ongoing basis. God damn. All right, here's Don Taylor.
A Washington State woman has been accused of impersonating her mother, who died in 2007, in order to collect her pension benefits. Lowen B. Kraft, 59, was charged with identity theft, criminal impersonation, and several counts of forgery. Yahoo News reported that Detective John Algier, who first became suspicious of Kraft while investigating an unrelated case of arson, arrested her at a credit union on March 2nd. The Bellingham Herald reported that she showed up in disguise to complete paperwork for an account she had opened using her dead mother's name and Social Security number, but officials were waiting for her. Investigators said Kraft checked her mother, Betty Becker, into a hospital in 2007, and the 90-year-old woman died shortly after that. It is thought that Kraft, who filed for bankruptcy in 2002, was able to fraudulently obtain $145,000 from the Chevron Oil Pension Fund by impersonating her mother. At one time, the company became suspicious after finding Becker's name on a registry of deceased people, but Kraft allegedly put on a gray wig and makeup and got an identification card in her mother's name.
That's so creepy. Okay.
Yeah. She notarized documents at financial institutions while posing as her mother.
I'm just picturing, like, Jonathan Winters, like, the you know, the, like, holding the rolling pin with, the, like, the gray bun of hair.
That was an episode of Scooby-Doo, wasn't it?
Yeah, but wasn't it, like, an actual character? Didn't Winters play, like, wasn't his own mother or something? But
no,
didn't he have some elderly female character?
Yes, Auntie somebody. Yeah, I can't remember the name of the
But I think that was like one of those characters where like that's why they eventually put him in the ha-ha
hole. It was Shaggy
hole.
That figured out the pension fraud.
Was it?
Yeah.
Well, if it always is.
Kraft's adopted daughter, Ariel Stanwyck, said, "It is bizarre. She would wear large glasses to impersonate my grandmother. She would even wear makeup on her face to wear liver spots to look old."
Okay. There we go. By the way, occasionally you'll just see like an email or something come in and you realize that it makes a lot of sense if looked in, you know, if looked through the prism of, you know, 10 minutes ago or if it's related to some story and you know what the story is. Occasionally, though, you look at one of those messages that comes in and you realize it must be related to something. You just don't know what it is. Like this one, this message just says, "Wimmy Wom Wom Wazzle." That's it. Anyone?
No.
See, I even know what that sound is. That is Wimmy Wom Wom Wazzle. That is the sound that Slurms McKenzie, who is the subterranean slug mascot of the Slurm Company on Futurama. He's sort of a Willy Wonka type figure. That's the sound that he makes. It's his catchphrase, followed by just sort of falling over into a collapsed heap, because I think they've got him. Because the implication is that they've got him strung out on like meth or something all the time, just to keep him up. And he greets everybody at the door because Fry and Leela and whoever. Fry opens like the 1 millionth can of Slurm, and he wins a trip to the Slurm factory, and they're greeted at the door by Slurms McKenzie, who is a small slug wearing a top hat and waving a cane, and he says, "Whammy wham wham wazzle." And then he just falls
that's a
over.
Charlie Sheen reference.
And that must be
Maybe.
It. And then he just falls over and goes, "I'm so tired." And then he just begins to cry.
Yeah.
So that must be what it is. Charlie Sheen is the Slurm Worm.
Hmm.
Awesome. We will do this. We'll come back around the corner. We'll do the top five. We've got that coming up. Also, let's we've got both. That was not our corpse watch, was it?
No, it was not. There was no corpse involved in that.
All right.
I still have a corpse.
We've got a corpse watch and a clown watch, really, if we have time. So that is all headed your way. This is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Stay right there.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Can use some exotic booze. There's a bar in far Bombay. Come on and fly with me. Let's fly away. Come fly with me. Let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come on, fly with me. Let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near, you may hear all the angels cheer, because we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It is perfect for a flying honeymoon. They say, come fly with me, let's fly away. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so very near, you might even hear a whole gang of cheers, just because we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a cuckoo day. You just say those words and we'll take our birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's so perfect for a flying honeymoon. Oh, babe, come fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away. Pack a small bag.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
My name ain't up in lights, but I'm a hero in this bar. And I play four big shows a night with just me and my guitar. But I don't make a lot of money, but I don't have a lot of gear. But I don't sell a lot of records, but I sure sell a lot.
If you wanna hear Bob Wills, I
every Sunday morning so I can go to church and pray. But after some of my Saturday nights, things just don't turn out that way. I thank even the good Lord, he understands I'm at that point in my
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us. It's 503-505-6964. Don't forget to join us tomorrow when our guests will include, listener Jenny and Scott, I believe, will be here as well to talk about the Sleep Country Bowling team that they put together, and which has been assembled for the sole purpose of crushing Aaron Duran and rendering him a shadow and a fragment of his former self.
Yeah, despite how supportive we were of him and his Sleep Country team earlier in the show, now that he's not here anymore.
That's right.
Don't give him
money.
Give us all the money.
It was a ruse. In just a few moments here, we'll roll out today's top five. And so I don't think you've ever received this this treatment, Ryan. So there's something we do. When is your birthday?
August.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's
August.
August. So August 2nd. So what is... So November. So come August, what we will do is we count down these songs from 9 months previous. So we try to assess with... I don't know, some degree of accuracy, what your parents might have had playing in the background while they made Sweet, Sweet Love in the by the light of the moon.
Pretty so. Sure my parents were listening to nothing, but...
Is that just because that's their preference?
My mom the other day, she was like, she goes, I should send you some records. When I was boasting about the fact that I got the record player working after the robbery that they threw across the room. Like, I was very proud that I'm not getting a new record player. I made the one that I had work, and she goes, I should send you some records. And I said, I don't want any of your records. You didn't have that many of them, and they all sucked.
What was the what was your parents' record collection like?
A bunch of Carpenter stuff and just stuff that has set me off. They had like Pet Sounds was the only listenable thing in that entire
a lot of Anne Marie
collection. There probably was. I just remember a lot of Carpenters and then Pet Sounds, and then like years later going through my grandmother's basement and finding my Uncle Bill's, my dad's brother's, like, box of, like, Stones and Zeppelin and all of that stuff.
And you think, like, where was this music when I was growing up? Like, why was I denied this?
This is why I, like, you know, kept my copy of Disney's Disco Duck until I was, you know, 18 or something.
Disco
like that.
Duck. Can I just tell you this? I believe it was on, I think, the first or the second date with my wife. Where, and I don't remember why this would have happened. I guess in retrospect, there's no context that would make it less insane. It was on our very first date with my we were actually at a restaurant, too. We were at dinner. And my wife began singing, Watch Out for Goofy. He's a disco demolition. For reasons that, again, I think have been lost now to the sands of time. So there are large
and
sections
your heart
of the
pitter-pattered.
And you said, there's the woman for me.
In big floppy dog shoes.
I got to say, I really did find it charming. So there are large sections of the Disco Mickey Mouse record, which are forever locked away in my wife's head, which will be there forever. At the news guest desk, it is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Let's do our corpse watch.
Here is your corpse watch for, what is this? This is Monday, yes?
Yes.
Here's your corpse watch for Monday, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program.
I'm digging up bones.
Digging up bones.
Exhuming things that's better left alone. But I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and sitting alone, digging up bones.
Here is Dawn Taylor with your corpse watch.
Authorities in Illinois first came in contact with Carl Snyder, 26, on Tuesday, not long after he stole a car from a neighbor and crashed it through a fence. Illinois state troopers tracked him down about 2 miles from the accident to a home that he had run to for help because he was bleeding, and they were able to follow the blood spots. When troopers took Carl Snyder to the hospital for treatment, he was behaving erratically and had to be sedated. They later transferred him to another hospital for questioning about the stolen car. It wasn't until about noon when they got a call from the Snyder family that the man's mother had not shown up for work, that police began to piece together the extent of his crime. When they arrived at his home, where he lived with his mother, they found that he had beaten and stabbed his mother to death before decapitating her and placing her head on the front porch. Carl Snyder had apparently flown into a rage and killed his mother shortly after she returned home from work Monday and told him she wanted to discuss putting him into a mental institution.
That's a conversation that you have after it's already been done, where you say, look, here's why. That is a post-incarceration discussion, where you say, look, here's why this had to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, he apparently the woman, Kathy Snyder, 49, died of multiple stab wounds and blunt trauma to the head. The medical examiner said it appeared she had been decapitated with a single-edged knife. Werner Snyder, the accused father, said his son had been treated for mental illness but had begun behaving even more strangely and babbling incoherently about a week ago. He said his son also had begun reading the Bible and quoting dark passages from the Book of Revelations.
This is like one of those. This is like how you break up. You break up with Ike Turner over the phone. You know, or you send him a telex or something. You don't. It's not necessarily. Not everything has to be handled in person. Not everything is better in a face-to-face discussion. That sometimes ends poorly for you.
Yeah, Carl Snyder had lived with his mother on and off for years. The woman's ex-husband said his son had a long history of drug abuse. He has convictions for stealing baby formula, drug possession, and domestic abuse.
See, that's one of those things where it freaks you out, like where they go to the guy's house and he's just got like a room full of baby formula and like a drawer full of hammers and bags of broken glass everywhere and nothing else. And just sort of sits in the room, you know, like naked talking about purification.
Yeah, he also apparently for the last several months had been fighting his so-called drug demons by throwing himself into exercise. The manager of the Gold's Gym in Palatine, where he was a regular, said he would exercise for 2 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Yes, I think the demons won that.
I think the demons won.
That's a rout. All right, there's your corpse watch. Before we do anything else, Don, I'm going to toss that to you. We will do that top five here in just 1 second. I do want to take this opportunity to give you clue number one for this week's Name That Snack contest from E.H. Vending. That's from E.H. Vending. Last week's winner, Diane, who successfully... Here's the thing. I didn't even know what it was. Because last week, the clues were just got so bizarre and so strange. And I think Cheryl at one point just quit putting the answer on the page for fear that I would inadvertently reveal it. I had no idea. I had no idea what last week's was, and it was a Klondike bar, which I never would have figured out.
I was thinking all week that it was ice cubes. The little... Because it was chocolate, it was cool or cold.
Are ice cubes like a Klondike bar?
They're those little chocolates that taste weirdly cool. They're little milk
like
chocolates.
Like a mint?
not really a mint. I don't know how, you don't know what an ice cube is? It's called an ice cube. They're tiny, and they sell them by the cash register.
Ryan White?
No idea, but I'm thinking cool and square also describes Ice Cube, the rapper.
Yeah, so, you know,
and I thought that
depending
was what,
on the day of the week.
And I thought that was what the song was, that you're probably, oh, it must be Ice Cube, the rapper.
Well, now I want to try one of these Ice Cubes.
Oh, well, we'll get some.
Can I find those at a convenience store near me?
Probably, yes.
Awesome. So congratulations to Diane. And it's Diane James who sussed out the last week's snack was Klondike Bar. We'll give you a clue number one for this week in just a moment. Don't forget, you can contact EH Vending at 503. You can contact... I just managed to bite my tongue there. I'm going to play through it, though, through the pain, because I'm a professional. You can contact EH Vending at 503-897-8204 in Portland, or you can contact them in Vancouver if you like. Josh, the owner, can be found at 360-816-1853 or ehvending.com. They do everything from traditional snack and soda machines all the way up to the coffee service and beyond, such as glass front fridges if you're going to be stocking your own deli or your own store. You can contact them if you are feeling, if you feel right now that you're paying too much for your vending service, if the guy doesn't come around, you feel like you're understaffed, understocked, he comes by too infrequently to meet your needs, or you're just looking to trim your budget a little bit, they can find something that works for you. You can contact EH Vending at ehvending.com or call them at 503-897-8204. Longtime listeners of the Rick Emerson Show, please do tell them you heard it here. Clue number one for this week's Name That Snack contest is Storm Large. There you go. It's clue number one. Storm Large. Awesome. I see the gleam in your eye, Don, that you've already sussed out where I'm going with that.
No, I was just thinking something dirty.
Awesome. Well, the judges would, in fact, prefer that answer to the other. Awesome. Well done. Here's your top five for Monday.
4, 3, 2, 1, fire.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
All right, so this is a thing which is inflicted upon whoever happens to be in the studio when it is their birthday. We identify the songs from 9 months prior to your date of birth to try to get a handle on what it is that your parents may have had playing in the background while they held each other in that special way. Don Taylor, are you prepared to do today's top five?
I am indeed.
What is honorable mention from, and this, by the way, would be June 3rd, 1972. This would be June 3rd, 1972. Don Taylor?
The honorable mention is Gallery, Nice to Be With You.
Ryan White?
Oh, it's so nice.
Sounds like they need to tighten the E string on that guitar. They're rattling.
You know what this sounds like a little bit? I never really put this together. This sounds a bit like that Playground in My Mind song.
In my head, this is two-thirds of every song in two-thirds of all the songs in 1972.
Totally. And the rest of them are done by Player.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to imagine anyone having sex to this.
No.
No, this isn't the sex part. This is like the happy montage of running on the beach, getting ice cream, going to the pet store, and he brings up a puppy from the bin.
Clotheslining the jogger on the beach. I miss Leslie Nielsen.
Slipping something into her drink. Muffling her cries for help.
Well, you know your mom a lot better than we do.
Overshare. The 70s were a strange time, though. Where it was just, it was like everything seemed to be performed by either the Bellamy Brothers or a band that lived next door to the Bellamy Brothers.
So did they have any other hits other than this?
Ryan White, music editor from the Oregonian.
I'm sorry, I work in this century.
This is before
my time.
Just picture this residing comfortably next to like a Mac Davis box set.
I can't picture this residing comfortably anywhere.
These are the top five songs from 9 months prior to my birthday. That would be June 3rd, 1972. Don Taylor.
Number five, Roberta Flack, First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
So this is the gaze into each other's eyes portion of the montage?
Yes, it is. This is over dinner at Trader Vic's. I thought
one bowl of spaghetti.
And there we were sharing a surf and turf plate, and I knew. Sort of like romance comes to the sizzler. And the moon.
Sizzler.
I know I'm supposed to like this song, but I just don't.
Why are you supposed to like it?
Because it's a classic, and it's, you know, it was, you know,
it's horrible.
It's, I don't even know that it's horrible. I just don't really care for it. It's not like it's Ebola or anything. I just, Roberta Flack is.
That was actually a blurb on the record.
It's not like it's Ebola. Will not liquefy your intestines, Roberta Flack.
Child to be born 9 months from now. Ever I kissed you. I don't know why, but this song makes me think of Folgers ads.
Well, this is where you realize that, look, here's the thing. Not like Rick Emerson's blessed with copious amounts of soul or anything, but this is where you do realize that every culture has their Debbie Boone. I mean, that's just... every culture has their Anne Murray. I mean, that is... I know that you're not supposed to say things like that, but it's just true.
So what we're saying here, just for the record, is that Roberta Flack is the black Anne Murray.
I'm just saying that it's... It is one of those things that seems to exist in some equivalent form across all cultures and backgrounds, all social strata. Also, this song sounds like it's about 12 beats a minute.
Yeah. And slowing down, I think.
Okay. Should never listen to this while you're driving.
The engine blew.
Wow.
Like you can almost hear like the flapping of the flat tire.
By the way, Keelan wants to say, Rick, I co-sign. That statement is black approved. I go, thank you, sir. Appreciate that. God, it's like I'm listening to Darvocet. All right. These are the top five songs from 9 months prior to my birth, Don Taylor.
Now that your mother has been
lured
into submission.
Into a soundproof
the
van.
The sound of roofies taking effect.
Now Dad would play Neil Diamond, Song Sung Blue.
Was everybody just on Quaaludes in the 70s? Was that the thing? I thought it was a lot of blow going on. Why weren't these
everyone
things
was really,
more upbeat?
Everyone was very tired after the 60s was over.
Was this like on the Sunday morning? So this was like between your Friday night and Monday night visits to Studio 54. You'd just be sitting on the sofa in your dirty boxers looking at the front porch, watching the sprinkler go back and forth.
I have always loved Neil Diamond, and I have always thought that this is just a completely idiotic song.
You know, what I don't get is, I don't get Cracklin' Rosie. Doesn't that sound like a skin disease?
Yeah.
It sounds like some sort of a rash or some sort of a hardening of the epidermis you get.
Well, plus I get confused because somebody came out with a really super cheap carbonated rosé wine called Cracklin' Rosé after that song came out. So I always think it's about booze. Song blue,
sleeping on my pillow. The taste of country thyme lemonade takes you back home. Funny thing. You can see. Seriously, it's like all I see is like kids just running down the street with that thing where they're like chasing a barrel hoop with a stick, and then a guy's talking about Pepperidge Farm cookies.
So Nixon got elected, everybody was just asleep, and like the three people that weren't listening to Top 40 radio voted.
You're just dosing us with Neil Diamond. I'm sorry.
Boring horn section ever.
I think I forgot how to move there for a second. These are the top five songs from 9 months prior to my birth. Don Taylor, what might number three be?
Number three, The Shy Lights, Oh Girl.
All right. Well, we're trending upward at least.
We are.
It's almost a porn shuffle.
See, now we're getting sexy.
I'm here to fix the cable.
I'll put a screen capture of this up here in just a second. Just for the moment, Don and Ryan, you must come now look at the screen art that accompanies this on YouTube. I'll put this up here just a few so everybody can see it. But
oh,
I don't know what's going on there.
No.
It appears to be... I don't know what it appears to be.
It's a man in a sombrero embracing a...
But they're floating in the sky, and then there's... But there's, like, turnips or something. And then also... It's like the cover of one of those, you know, Unchained Passion things or something, where she's being ravaged by a guy with, like, a buckskin belt.
Kind of disturbed by the idea of, like, a half-naked muscular man in a sombrero.
That's either the best or worst romance novel ever.
Also, the Virgin Mary seems to be in the background for reasons that I can't quite quantify.
Or Joni Mitchell.
Or Joni Mitchell, sure. Wait, no. No, there's no more Gellens. It's the Virgin Mary.
So this is like R&B with a little, I don't know about that harmonica.
Well, I think that's a thing made acceptable by Stevie Wonder. I think, you know, it's, I think there are maybe certain instruments that are maybe grandfathered in because somebody cool once used them, and so therefore, you
know. Otis Redding used a little harmonica, didn't he? It still doesn't work in this song.
Yeah. The harmonica's like the flute. It really doesn't work anywhere.
Or is that a melodica? It almost doesn't sound like a harmonica.
Are you making that up?
No, there really is a thing called a melodica.
What is a melodica?
It's like a little keyboard with a oxygen hose coming through it, and you blow into it, and it's a strange little instrument. They're all over this town.
Well, it's 1972, so why not?
It could be a melodica.
Yeah, okay, I did it again. Sorry. These are the top five songs from 9 months prior to my birth. Don Taylor, we're at number two. What might it be?
The Staple Singers, I'll Take You There.
All right. It's like we're washing the ick away.
Yes.
You say that, but then this is actually a song that was very likely going on.
Playing in the background.
Yes.
Well, here's the thing. I would embrace that if only because it means that for one glorious shining moment, my father had good taste in music. Because other than this, I mean, it would just be nothing but Herman's Hermits records and, you know, and like a Ricky Nelson box set, so. And all my mom listened to was like Mahalia Jackson records, so the idea, you know, and that's just disturbing.
There was, like, Conan last week, Mavis Staples was on doing a song off her newest record, which is just awesome.
I think...
She's coming to Pickathon this summer.
You were the one telling us about that. I think I was actually on... And it was like on one of the Napster every Tuesday is a mix of like stuff that has come out recently within the last few months or whatever. And I think that did come up. And I was listening to part of it, and it was fantastic.
Oh, it's wonderful. Jeff Tweedy produced it. Can't wait for that set at Pickathon this summer.
Alright. Well, now that the good times are here, let's chase them away once again, Don. Is the number one song from 9 months prior to my birth?
Oh, you say that, but it's Sammy Davis Jr., The Candyman.
Now we're just back to abduction.
All right, everybody, gather around. The Candyman is here. What kind of
everybody gather around. It's the near nadir of my professional life.
Candy, gumdrops,
and post-coital
come
cuddling.
To the right, man.
Everyone, come here. Witness my career immolation.
Who can take the sunrise, it with you.
Now I'm just picturing him arm in arm doing like a series of kick turns with Anton LaVey.
And a miracle to the Candyman.
The Candyman.
Ooh, the Candyman can.
The Candyman can.
The Candyman can, cause he mixes it with love and makes the world taste good.
It's like he just wanted to justify all the abuse Sinatra heaped on him over the years.
Just like your mother's egg could have been splitting right now.
Why would you ever say that? Why would that ever occur to you as a thing you should say?
You could be turning into a zygote while Sammy Davis Jr. is singing about a groovy lemon pie.
He mixes it with love and makes the world taste.
Mixes it with love, does he? Thanks. Oh, I hope you die poor and alone, Don.
Hear Weezer cover this.
Now you talk about your childhood wishes. You can even eat the dishes.
Okay, we're done. We're done.
Written by Anthony Newley.
Oh, who can take tomorrow?
The Rick Emerson Show is brought to you today by Dawn.
It was song by People Houses. Think about that.
Happy birthday, Rick Emerson.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We come to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the Milkpacking District in glorious Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, Advanced Technology and Magic, provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, Executive Producer Bruce Ago, Chief of Staff Cheryl Kanakoa. We want to thank our guests, including Mr. Aaron Duran. Find out more at about the Weekend Geek at geekinthecity.com. And Ryan Wright, we didn't hear read him in print in the Oregonian or online at OregonLive.com/music. That is OregonLive.com/music. After a brief interlude, we'll have an encore of today's Legion of News radio program brought to you by Squires Electric. Proud sponsors of this program, which will encore after Legion of News. Now I'm swaying back and forth, you bastards. All right. Thank you all for listening. It is Monday, March 7th, 2011. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now.
The Candyman can, 'cause he mixes it with love and makes the world.